Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
It was always a myth that you will have such forums for international economic cooperation running with the exclusion of large parts of the world. Now we are moving towards a direction that includes those parts of the world that were excluded.
As the African Union joins the G20 as a permanent member, we'll take a close look at the G20 summit, which just wrapped up in India, including Chinese President Xi Jinping's absence, how the summit fell short on addressing the climate emergency, and why Russia is praising the G20's final statement on the war in Ukraine. Then to Santiago, Chile, to look at how Henry Kissinger and President Nixon supported a coup in Chile 50 years ago this week, when General Augusto Pinochet ousted the democratically elected President Salvador Allende.
The 50th anniversary of the coup in Chile is an extraordinarily important date, not only for Chileans, but for the rest of the world that is struggling with democracy versus the forces of authoritarianism.
And as interest begins accruing again on federal student loans, we'll speak to Astra Taylor, author of the new book, The Age of Insecurity, Coming Together as Things Fall Apart.
My new book, The Age of Insecurity, looks at the way our economy is structured to make us all insecure by design, or what I call manufactured insecurity. Capitalism thrives on bad feelings, on making us feel like we'll never have enough or be enough, or that the rug could be pulled out from under us at any moment. And I think recognizing this is actually very essential to building the solidarity that we need to address the various political crises that we're facing today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of people are feared dead in Libya after a powerful Mediterranean cyclone brought devastating flooding to the eastern port city of Derna. Libya's National Center of Meteorology says the storm dumped more than 16 inches of rain on the city in less than 24 hours, causing two dams to burst, washing away entire neighborhoods. On Monday, a spokesperson for the Libyan National Army put the death toll in the thousands.
The latest update regarding the death toll, as the Prime Minister of Libya announced, exceeds 2,000 in Derna city alone. May they rest in peace. There are also in Derna thousands of missing people, some 5,000 to 6,000 missing people, and this number could largely increase.
Libya's Red Crescent said the number of missing people has reached 10,000, with at least 20,000 displaced from their homes. Much of Libya's infrastructure has crumbled since 2011, when the Obama administration and NATO backed an uprising against the longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi, setting off years of war. The catastrophic floods in Libya were triggered by Storm Daniel, a rare hurricane-like cyclone in the Mediterranean known as a metacane. It's the same storm that brought unprecedented flooding to Greece, Turkey, and Bulgaria last week. In Greece, public health officials are warning residents against using stagnant flood water amidst fears over the spread of disease, while supplies of clean drinking water remain scarce. Nearly a quarter of this year's crop production was lost to flooding in Greece's central agriculture-producing region. In Morocco, hopes of finding survivors of last Friday's devastating earthquake are fading, as the government said the death toll is near 3,000. The United Nations says at least 300,000 people have been affected by the quake, a third of them children. Here in the United States, the number of major climate-related disasters so far this year has already set records. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, said Monday 23 separate weather and climate disasters have caused at least $1 billion in damages from January to August, surpassing the previous record set in all of 2020. In Geneva, the United Nations top human rights official said Monday, wealthy nations are failing to take steps needed to prevent the worst effects of the climate catastrophe. Volker Türk spoke to the UN Human Rights Council after the G20 wrapped up a weekend summit in India with no commitment to phase out fossil fuels.
Climate change is pushing millions of people into famine. It is destroying hopes, opportunities, homes, and lives. In recent months, urgent warnings have become lethal realities again and again all around the world. We do not need more warnings. The dystopian future is already here. We need urgent action now.
Ukraine's intelligence service says Ukrainian forces have seized control of four strategically important oil and gas drilling platforms in the Black Sea near the Russian-annexed Crimean Peninsula. Officials in Kyiv accused Russia of using the platforms as ammunition depots and radar stations and said their seizure brought Ukraine one step closer to President Zelensky's goal of recapturing Crimea. NATO's planning its largest military exercise since the Cold War. The Financial Times reports the war games in Germany and Poland next February and March will involve more than 50 naval vessels, 40,000 military personnel, hundreds of simulated air combat missions. On Monday, Sweden's government announced plans to boost military spending by nearly 30% ahead of its accession to NATO. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has expressed alarm after the Pentagon launched joint military exercises with Armenia's armed forces in the former Soviet Republic, along time regional partner of Russia. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has arrived in Russia for talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Kim made the journey from Pyongyang to the eastern Russian city of Vladivostok aboard an armored train. Putin is reportedly seeking to purchase stockpiles of North Korean artillery shells and rockets for Russia's war effort in Ukraine. In exchange, North Korea could receive food, fuel and technology from Moscow. In Washington, D.C., the State Department threatened new sanctions against Russia and North Korea, saying any such deal would violate multiple Security Council resolutions. In Niger, leaders of the military junta that seized power in July are accusing France of massing troops and equipment in neighboring ECOWAS nations in preparation for military intervention in Niger.
These underhanded delaying tactics are designed to dull the patriotic ardor of the Niger people in their fight for the total withdrawal of French troops from Niger in order to achieve a more successful military intervention against our country.
Tension has been escalating between Niger and its former colonial ruler, France, since the military coup. French troops and France's ambassador have ignored demands to leave Niger. The Biden administration's cleared the way to release $6 billion in Iranian oil revenue blocked by U.S. sanctions in exchange for five Americans imprisoned in Iran. Five Iranian nationals currently imprisoned in the United States are also being released as part of the agreement. Iranian officials will be allowed to use the funds to buy food, medicine and other humanitarian needs. Republicans have fiercely criticized the deal. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton accused President Biden of, quote, paying ransom to the world's worst state sponsor of terrorism, unquote. In the occupied West Bank, hundreds of Palestinians took to the streets Sunday demanding justice for 16-year-old Milad Al-Rai, who was killed by Israeli soldiers during a raid on a refugee camp near the city of Hebron a day earlier. Some 185 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank so far this year, including dozens of children and teens. Last week, the former head of Israel's spy service, Mossad, said Israel's imposing apartheid on Palestinians. Tamir Pardo told the Associated Press, quote, in a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state, he said. Here in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration's approved new COVID-19 booster shots for people as young as 6 months old, with vaccination set to begin as soon as this week. The vaccines produced by Pfizer and Moderna have been reformulated against an Omicron coronavirus subvariant that was dominant when the shots were selected by the FDA in June. The vaccines are the first COVID shots not to be purchased by the federal government. Most health insurance plans, including Medicare, will cover the cost of the vaccines. Meanwhile, the CDC will administer a program to cover the cost of vaccinating people without insurance or whose plans won't cover the shots. This month, the World Health Organization warned of a concerning rise in COVID-19 cases ahead of winter in the Northern Hemisphere.
But hospitalizations are increasing in the Americas, in Europe, in what we call our Southeast Asia region. And that is of worry, given that when we get to colder months in some countries, people tend to spend more time indoors, aggregated together. And viruses that transmit through the air, like COVID, will take advantage of that.
In Washington, D.C., at least seven people were arrested Monday for peacefully occupying the office of House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, demanding Congress reauthorize funding for a global program to prevent and treat HIV and AIDS. The president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, known as PEPFAR, is set to expire on September 30th and has been stalled by Republicans who claim some of the funds have been used for abortion access. HousingWorks CEO Charles King was among those arrested. The nonprofit said in a statement, quote, PEPFAR has saved millions of lives. It's criminal for some members of Congress to treat it as a political football. And in Georgia, Atlanta city officials are facing backlash after they refused to begin counting and verifying over 116,000 signatures submitted by activists Monday in support of a public referendum that could block the construction of Cop City, the massive $90 million police training center that would be the largest in the United States. The effort now appears to be in legal limbo after an appellate court suspended a previous order by another judge that had granted activists more time to turn in the petitions. The original deadline to get the measure on the ballot was August 21st. Atlanta officials said they won't verify signature forms until the appellate court rules on whether the deadline extension was lawful. This is the latest setback for the Stop Cop City movement. It comes after 61 protesters were indicted on racketeering charges. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden's arrived back in the United States after attending the G20 summit in India and making a state visit to Vietnam. The G20 summit brought together leaders from many of the world's largest economies, but there were two notable absences, Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin. In a key development, the African Union has been admitted to the G20 as a permanent member. The AU consists of 55 member states with a population of over 1.3 billion. Much of the negotiations at the G20 centered on joint statement that included a section on the war in Ukraine. The final statement made no reference to Russia's aggression in Ukraine. Instead, the document stated, quote, all states must refrain from the threat or use of force to seek territorial acquisition, unquote. Meanwhile, on the climate crisis, the G20 joint statement called for just a, quote, phase down of coal instead of a phase out, as many demanded. Other fossil fuels weren't mentioned in the statement. The G20 also ignored calls for nations to enact new taxes on the ultra-rich. On the sidelines of the G20, the United States, India, Saudi Arabia, and the European Union announced plans for a major railway and port project to connect the Middle East with India. Many see the proposal as an alternative to China's Belt and Road Initiative. The summit represented the first time that the G20 has met in India. Ahead of the gathering, India faced criticism for bulldozing slum areas in New Delhi, leaving many residents without a home. The G20 summit also occurred as Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi appears to be moving toward changing the name of India to Bharat, a Sanskrit term which is already India's second official name but is not widely used internationally. Invitations to dinners during the G20 use the name Bharat instead of India. To talk about all this and more, we're joined by Jayati Ghosh, an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, previously an economics professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India, where she taught for 35 years. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor. It's great to have you with us. Why don't you talk about what you thought was most significant outcome from the G20 and all the developments within it and the negotiations?
I think the basic lesson of this G20 meeting is that geopolitics is everything, and that the leaders of G20 are so intent on playing their particular geopolitical games right now that they really don't care about what is required for the world as a whole. And that's important because, if you remember, G20 was actually set up because it was argued that the UN is too unwieldy, the international organizations can't do what they're supposed to do, so we need a smaller, more agile group of the countries that really matter, who are going to actually go out there and do things. In fact, April 2009 was the high watermark of them doing anything. And since then, really, they haven't been effective. But now we are at the point where we're even grateful if they can get out a common statement. The whole year of India's G20 presidency, there was no common statement. This is the first one. And it's completely banal. It's bland. There is really nothing in terms of anything to deliver for the rest of the world or even for their own country's people.
Professor Ghosh, let's go to, speaking of statements, the Ukraine statement, the war statement, which was apparently negotiated over 100 hours. I didn't even think the summit lasted that long. Can you explain what came out of it and why Russia is so pleased with it?
I think this statement actually reflects India's growing political clout because all these countries are trying to court India. And what it does is it's a backtracking from the statement in Bali, the Indonesian presidency, in which the invasion by Russia of Ukraine was condemned and in which there was a request for the withdrawal immediately. All of that has gone. There's no mention of Russia. It's a very bland kind of statement that says, yes, you know, hostilities should cease and countries should not try and get more territory from one another, kind of equating the two. And this is a reflection of the fact that the G7, let's face it, currently sees India as more important than, or rather the current leadership in India as more important to court than standing up for what is clearly something very strong on their agenda otherwise in Ukraine, or even for human rights in India and other countries.
So President Xi Jinping was not there. President Vladimir Putin was not there. The significance of this?
Well, Putin can't attend any international conferences in countries that, because of the problem that he could be arrested because of the warrant against him. That's happened in South Africa, for example, recently, and of course now in India. But the absence of Xi Jinping, which was a relatively recent announcement, is interesting. It's Xi Jinping saying he can't be bothered wasting his time. He went to the BRICS summit just the week before, and it was a significant summit because it involved the expansion of the BRICS. He's going to various other international organizations. He's really telling G7, we don't need you.
And can you talk about climate change, the climate catastrophe, and how the G20 addressed it? So many climate activists around the world and right now, victims of global heating, so deeply concerned about the lack of real statement about it.
In fact, what is most appalling is that this G20 has done nothing for the major problems of our time, and which are no longer in the future. They're all upon us, as we know. Climate change, absolutely, and the major disasters that are occurring across the world, really nothing of significance, just the usual statements that mean nothing. No concrete plan of action, just a general statement to work towards reducing fossil fuels, as if nothing has changed, as if, you know, the world is still the same world that it was even last year, which it is not. So there was nothing really on any meaningful movement on climate change. There was nothing on resolving the major debt crisis, which in about 80 countries today is worsening the possibilities of dealing with climate change as well. And yet this was an issue that India had made one of the major concerns of its presidency. Modi had actually said, we are going to work towards a resolution of the debt crisis. Nothing on that. A terrible silence on the lack of taxation strategies, for example, wealth taxes on the very rich and sharing of information that would enable that, or even a better deal for corporate taxation than the one that is currently on the table. Nothing in terms of finding the resources that would enable countries to deal with not just the mitigation, but right now just the dealing with the impacts of climate change that so many are facing.
The African Union has been admitted to the G20 as a permanent member. The AU consists of 55 member states with a population of over 1.3 billion, just under the population of India. This is South African President spokesperson Vincent Magwenya.
It was always a myth that you will have such forums for international economic cooperation running with the exclusion of large parts of the world. And now we are moving towards a direction that includes those parts of the world that were excluded.
So talk about the significance of the African Union now being a permanent member of the G20, and also whether you see the G20 descending in power and BRICS, right? Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, the conference that just took place in South Africa, ascending.
Well, you know, the African Union should always have been a member. It's absurd that the European Union was a member and the African Union was not. I mean, that absolutely is the case. And so clearly, this is something that should have happened much earlier. But what's the point of just being invited to parties, which is really now what it's become? It's a talking shop and it's parties. No outcomes, nothing major, no serious initiative that would actually transform anything in the world today, whether on global health or on global public investment generally or on all of the issues that I've just mentioned. So, yes, it's good that Africa is part of the party, but that's about it, because it's not the G20 is no longer doing anything. Now, that brings me to then what does it mean relative to the other groupings that are emerging? And, you know, BRICS Plus, for example. I think, you know, what we're seeing is a period of significant realignments. So it's all these pieces moving around on chessboards in a game where everybody wants to suss out what the other player is doing, but no one's quite sure, and they can change. So I think what we're entering is a period of significant instability, not just globally in the economic terms, as we know, but also in terms of geopolitics. Different alliances, different shades of cooperation or antagonism. And it's no longer certainly unipolar, but I don't think there are very clear poles. Everybody says China is another pole. It's not yet of that same level, but definitely there are many more different alliances. And we're going to see many more of those, whether they're expressed in groupings or not. Is the G20 losing power? Well, you know, what power does it have? What has it done with that power over the last, really, more than 12 years? So I would say the G20 is a collection of potentially very powerful governments that don't necessarily represent the interests of their own people, I might add. But nonetheless, this collection has not done very much over the last 12, 13 years.
And can you also talk about the sidelines of the G20? The U.S., India, Saudi Arabia, European Union announcing plans for this major railway and port project to connect Middle East with India. Many see it as a proposal to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative and the also normalization even further of MBS into the international community, Mohammed bin Salman.
Oh, I think the normalization of MBS is complete. And it shows how little G20 leaders really care about human rights. And I think that's evident also in the courting of Narendra Modi, who has been responsible for quite significant democratic backsliding in India. But what will this new initiative achieve? Well, I'll wait to see if they put their money where their mouth is. There have been many attempts by US and Europe to counter the Chinese influence, as they call it, in terms of the Belt and Road Initiative or other kinds of things. But then they just talk a lot. They don't really put money in there. The difference is that China actually put significant resources and generated significant investments. So let's see if that happens. At the moment, I'm a little doubtful.
And what about the calls on G20 nations to agree on increasing taxes on the global wealthy? In the last decade, billionaires have more than doubled their wealth from 5.6 to $11.8 trillion. You were among the signatories of a letter addressed to the G20 ahead of the summit this weekend, along with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, the former U.N. General Assembly President Marianne Espinosa, and hundreds of others. Outline what you're calling for. How would this tackle global inequity and rising poverty?
You know, there are two things going on here. One is that even as we talk about, you know, extreme inequality, it keeps rising by the day. Inequality is ballooning beyond any historical norms, beyond anything we could have imagined even 10 years ago. And yet we don't have minimal resources to address not just basic needs of humans, not just for meeting the sustainable development goals, but even to address the calamities that are occurring upon people. So we desperately need to raise public investments. This whole idea that you can do it through these public-private partnerships, leveraging public funds for private, is fine in principle. But right now you need public resources. You absolutely have to generate the money to do these basic things. And it's so easy because there is this obscene wealth creation, which is really a result of influencing government regulations and government policies. All you have to do is tax a little bit of that in a way that they wouldn't even notice, because frankly, no one notices that level of extreme ownership. No, they don't really, certainly they don't use all that wealth, but they don't actually notice how much there is when you're into those billions and so on. So in fact, relatively small wealth taxes on the extremely wealthy, not on all wealth, on the extremely wealthy, would generate very significant amounts of revenue. Even in countries like India, you would get, for example, less than 1,000 families, if you tax them 4% of their wealth, you would get 1% of GDP, which is double the total health expenditure, public health expenditure in the country. So you could do this very easily. It's a question that is striking that all these meetings, they come and they talk about blah, 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 blah. They don't address some of the easy, low-hanging fruit that could have been agreed to, just sharing information that would enable people, the governments, to institute wealth taxes on the rich of their own countries, wherever they keep their wealth.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about Prime Minister Narendra Modi's placard at the opening of the G20 summit on Saturday, referring to India as Bharat, raising speculation of a change of name for India. Can you talk about the significance of this very old and now new for the international community name, what it means and what it represents?
You know, it's a very strange thing that has just happened. The Constitution of India says India, that is Bharat. And very often when we're speaking in Hindi or in some other Indian language, we use the term Bharat. And the two have been interchangeable forever. Certainly all my life, I remember them being used interchangeably. But suddenly this move to remove India from the international thing is bizarre, because they're claiming that it's a colonial remnant, which it's not. The word India comes way back. For example, it's from the river Sindh. And when Alexander crosses, they say, OK, the people on the other side of the Sindhu River. But so it's way back. OK, it goes. It's a very, very long history for the name India. But the real reason that they're doing this is because a group of opposition countries, I think now there are 24 in the opposition alliance, and they have called themselves India, INDIA, Indian National Democratic Inclusive Alliance. And this has actually created a lot of nervousness in the ruling party. So many people see this as a quite open knee-jerk reaction. Oh, you're going to call yourselves India? I am going to remove, expunge India from all official words. We won't allow you to claim India. It's bizarre. It would be funny if it weren't also so expensively ridiculous, because it will mean a huge expense in changing the names of everything. The Reserve Bank of India, for example, the currency notes and everything.
Is it similar to what's happened in Burma with the military junta renaming Burma Myanmar? Yes, Burma is a colonial name. And in the case of India with Narendra Modi, would you say it signifies a kind of Hindu supremacy, even though it's Sanskrit, not Hindi?
I would say that pretty much everything this government does is has an underlining of an attempt to impose Hindu supremacy. So yes, this is certainly part of that. But the immediate sort of bringing in of this measure is really a panicky response to the fact that the opposition parties are coming together and calling themselves India.
Jayati Ghosh, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Economics professor now at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Next up to Santiago, Chile, where we continue our discussion on this 50th anniversary of the U.S.-supported coup. And look at how Henry Kissinger and President Nixon, what the role they played in supporting General Augusto Pinochet, ousting the democratically elected President Salvador Allende. Back in 30 seconds.
Pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had.
Redemption song covered by Joe Strummer and the Mascara.